Hello and welcome. This is Friend Request. I'm your host, Justin Lamb, and this is episode 151 with my friend, Tawny Lara. I got to know Tawny through the Sober Curator, and you guys have heard some of those guests, but here's another one. And Tawny talks a little bit about a brand new book that she just published, and we get into all sorts of fun topics. So I'm not going to hold you back any much longer. I'm keeping that in there. This is, without further ado, my friend, Tawny.
You and I have lots in common. My request is sent. Would you like to be my friend? Would you like to be my friend?
It's silly, but hi.
Hello.
Thank you, first of all, for doing this and sitting down and taking time out of your day.
Of course.
I normally start these out with how I know people, and I don't know. I don't know if I'd say I know you. We've been on Zooms together.
Yes.
But that may be the extent of knowing you, really. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's just the internet now.
Well, yeah.
I've been on podcasts before, like my friend, now friend Dubs, but they were like, I'm glad to have you on, but like, how do I know you? I forgot. Like, how do we know each other? And so, yeah, I don't really know, but we just do.
Yeah. I think our mutual existence within the realm of the Sober Curator is essentially how we know each other to whatever degree that is. So cool. I want to kind of dive into who you are as a person and then venture into what I suppose at this point, after having a published book, you could say you're an expert on. So prior to getting there, Tawny, where are you from? What's your story? What's your deal?
My deal.
Where did you grow up? New York? Because you're there now, right?
I live in New York. I moved here in June of 2015. Okay. And I grew up split between Northern California and Central Texas. And then moved to New York when I was 29. Okay. And I cannot imagine living anywhere that does not have amazing public transportation.
Yeah, that is the downfall of so many areas.
You know, I did not think that public transportation would be one of my favorite things about living in New York City. And it 100% is. Like, obviously there's like so many great things about living here, but anytime I'm traveling and I have to rent a car, or a friend talks to me about like, oh yeah, I had a flat tire or gas prices, I'm like, I forgot that those are things people deal with.
Yeah. It's funny that I care so much about public transportation since I've quit drinking. Like when I was drinking, absolutely. I was like, oh, I can go get like shitty at a bar and then I don't have to drive home.
Yeah.
Hopefully. And it's wild that that would still be a huge appeal. Like I've been to DC a number of times since I quit drinking, and I love their subway system there, which is a strange thing to love about a city. But
no, it's not. It's Boston has a good public transportation system. I really wish more cities would embrace public transportation. Yeah. I know that's a huge ask. There's a lot of bureaucratic red tape with that.
There's a lot of gentrification with that.
There's so much to unpack there, but long story short, I really love
perfect
the subway system. It's not perfect, but I love it.
Are you born in Northern California?
I was born in Northern California.
Okay. What particular area, if I dare ask?
I was born in Walnut Creek.
Okay. And sounds like a clothing grew brand.
Up in like Alameda, Concord, Walnut Creek area. Okay. And then mom and I moved to Waco, Texas, and dad stayed in the Bay Area. So I grew up back and forth.
Gotcha. Any siblings?
Only child.
Oh, so much baggage comes with that.
I am, you know, still unpacking it in therapy every week. It's these little things that you don't realize are like your birth order really impacts you. And I think that's really, really interesting. a friend of mine is the oldest of four, and so is my husband. And it's interesting, we have a lot in common just based on the oldest and being the only child. There is a lot of expectation that you do have to step up and wear the bigger hat in the family.
How old are you when your parents divorce?
Well, they were never married.
Okay.
But I mean, I've never really known them together, honestly. Okay. I don't know.
Can you elaborate on what that looks like growing up? Like,
they were together for, they probably split up when I was like two or three.
Oh, okay.
So it was split custody in California and then split custody when I moved to Texas and spent all of my summers in California, but I went to school in Texas.
So did you go to Texas when you moved down there or when you were just a baby?
I was eight.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So I consider Texas home. But California was still a really big part of my growing up.
I was going to say, what do you think influenced you more as a person? Like, when I think of Northern California and Waco, those are two very different places.
Yes, very much so. It's interesting because when I tell people I'm from Waco, Texas, they're like, what? And I'm like, well, I was born in the San Francisco Bay Area. They're like, oh, okay. So it's, you know, yes, I was raised in Waco, but I was raised by, you know, a single mom from the Bay Area who did, I was not raised with like Southern Baptist values at all. She was the, you know, heavy metal punk rock mom. We were the weirdos in Waco, but I weirdly think that growing up in both in such polarizing places helps me see difficult situations with nuance, difficult subjects with nuance. I can be diplomatic about a lot of issues because I truly can empathize with both sides of the political spectrum. But it's, and then especially now being in New York, it's like, I'm in a liberal bubble here. And every time I go back to Texas, I'm just like, it's very jarring. I'm like, ooh.
Oh, I bet.
Forgot. Forgot that there's like Trump flags everywhere.
Yeah. Did you, I'm curious, embrace the, you said like we were the weirdos in Waco. Did you embrace the weirdo mentality as a child in your social circles and your hobbies? And what did that look like?
Yeah, I always had some... I was always part of like some club with my friends. Like we had a sticker club and we had a Spice Girls club.
Who didn't?
And these weren't like actual, I mean, I don't really know what defines a club. We would just hang out at recess and like trade stickers.
There were no formal membership cards issued out.
Yeah. There was, no one was documenting the minutes. Just, we called it our sticker club.
Oh, what if they did though? Wouldn't you love to have those minutes now to look back?
I would, I've never thought about that, but yes, I would kill to have like those conversations again.
Tawny Ray's concern about Baby Spice's outfit during the last tour.
Yes, exactly.
That's amazing. And you said your mom is a punk rocker. What kind of personality traits did you take from her? And then what did you take from dad as far as
that stuff? So my dad is my dad's a heavy metal musician and my mom was his groupie. So I was raised in a very
angry,
a very loud,
heavy
metal environment. Like I always went to bars, you know, like as a toddler, I was going to bars and concerts. Just, I was always around live music and recording studio. And my mom was not a musician, but she's an avid, rock fan, like an avid, like a trivia aficionado. I mean, so I get like, I think I get the creativity from my dad. I'm not a musician, but I, you know, writing is my medium for self-expression. And with my mom, she was like, you know, we'd be listening to songs or going to a concert or whatever. And she was quizzing me on like, who's the lead singer? Where's the band from? What's the album? What's the artist discography? So I have this arsenal of, you know, arguably useless trivia in my head. And I hope one day I'll be on a game show and I can win a bunch of money knowing all this random music stuff.
I have a personal fondness for that specific thing that I think parents probably do, generally speaking. But the little relationship I had with my dad, I have a lot of memories of us like being in his car and something coming on and be like, you know who this is? And then he'd have to tell me, you know, oh, this is Pink Floyd and this is Marshall Tucker Band, and always like quizzing me as if it's like, this is the stuff you got to know. So do you know it or not? And those are the like small fond memories I have of those times. So I love that little parental, like, I was the cool kid, I got to teach you how to be the cool kid fucking thing.
Yeah. Well, and then it's like, I took that on and I was like quizzing my friends.
Oh yeah.
And
you fall into the trap, you know, of judgy, like your friends. Oh, my,
of
my friends have the shittiest.
Wait, you don't know who Mick Jagger is? How do you not know who Mick Jagger is?
Yeah.
You know, well, yeah. That was a very important educational information in our household. Yeah. So, and I'm still like that, you know, growing up, I just genuinely enjoyed learning about the Y2K artists that I was listening to. I wanted to know everything about the Spice Girls and Eminem. And I still do it today.
Yeah. It's awesome. That's a fun little music area that I have never been able to fully embrace. And I'm always cautious about like saying who my favorite bands are to people that also like that band, because they'll be like, oh yeah, like I'll be like, oh, I love Counting Crows, and be like, oh, you like when Randy does that thing and that one song? I'm like, no, hold on. I like the Counting Crows, like I like their songs. I couldn't tell you more than like one of the members' names. I don't know,
yeah,
like the weird B-side stories that people read in blogs, like that's never been my thing. But people assume that it is when it's like a favorite band of yours. It's like, no, I like the music. I don't.
Yeah, well, that's so real. And Counting Crows, I just know. I know Adam Duritz is the lead singer. And I saw this. There is this funny meme going around Twitter of how Adam Duritz is the Gen X version of Pete Davidson. And there's like pictures of Adam Duritz in the 90s with
he's
actress
dated everybody
of the time.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Courtney Cox and Jennifer Aniston. I mean, half the cast of Friends.
Yeah, he was with everyone, and you know. But it's an apt comparison. Pete Davidson's dating all of the hot women now. That was what Adam Duritz did. So yeah.
We're all learning lessons about ourselves. with your summers in California and the rest of like the quote unquote work years, I guess, when you're in school and everything down in Texas, what does that do with your relationship with your mom and then with your dad? Like how does that form and play out?
I mean, I was essentially raised by a single mom, you know. Dad was kind of the stereotypical like Disneyland dad, you know, like we did all the fun stuff over the summer and he took me shopping for back to school clothes and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then mom was the one who was the disciplinarian and raised me. And they had me when they were so young. My mom was 21. My dad was 24. And like, and now I can, after years of recovery and therapy, I'm able to look at that, at my parents with some distance and some love and be like, they were young. They were dealing with their own shit. And they didn't know how to take care of themselves, let alone take care of a kid. So I'm able to zoom out and empathize and see them as human beings now instead of just mom and dad.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was tough. It was really tough being, you know, only child raised by a single mom, and dad was around sporadically, but, you know, we made it.
Yeah. When you say you were in Northern California for the summers, and I promise we'll move on eventually. does that, are you saying the whole summer?
Yeah, it was pretty much like the bulk of the summer. And then like sometimes for the holidays, or dad would come to Texas for the holidays, but Yeah, it was like a good chunk of the time.
What does that do to your social relationships? Because I imagine the FOMO's real, right? Because all your friends you have during the school year are doing stuff all summer and you're just not involved. And when you come back, you don't have any.
It was, I had my summertime California friends.
Yeah.
I had some friends that I already had there because I lived there for 8 years. So I visited them, and then I made other friends while I was visiting dad. And but like, I think FOMO was just so different back then because you didn't really know what you were missing out on. You weren't like I wasn't on Instagram seeing like, oh, they had this party, and I had no idea what I was missing. So it was fine, I guess.
There wasn't like a feeling of, I mean, the way I imagine it is it's just more difficult to have deeper friendships as time goes on. And you're like, you know, once you hit middle school and stuff like that, because you're not there all the time, right? Like everyone else is there all the time. Whether it's everyone in California, they're all there for each other all the time. Everyone in Texas, they're all there for each other all the time. And then you're like, I'll be here for you like 8 months of the year. These 4 months I'll be here. Like, and you are absent in a way. And I struggle to use that word in this case, but does that make sense? So that's why that question comes from.
Interesting. It's an interesting question because like, I don't know any other way. Okay. It's almost like, you know, military brats that have to move every 2 years. You just, that's how it is. That's the only way, you know. So this is all I knew. And, you know, maybe it helped me become a better, like be more social and be more outgoing. And I'm able to make friends very easily. And, I'm outgoing. And I think I probably learned that by having two homes in two different states, you know?
Let's shift lenses a little bit. When do substances enter your life in regards to, I mean,
being... I started self-medicating with drugs 14, 15, and moved on to, you know, once I went into the restaurant industry, that's really where it switched to drinking, and it was just like, partying all the time. I was, you know, 18, but when you work in the restaurant industry, it's very easy to drink in other restaurants and bars. I partied really hard from, you know, 15 to 29. And, I joke that was my research time.
If I'm going to write this book later in life, I need
I use that as, I learned a great deal during those 14 years. And, I think that's just like something I came up with in therapy, is like to forgive myself for like the quote unquote lost time. I was like, I was researching my future work, and now I'm able to write about certain things and help other people with those things.
There you go. I was told I used this word wrong the other day, so I'm going to use it wrong again, maybe. But what was the antithesis to you starting to use drugs at 14, 15 years old?
I don't really go into that. It was just some shit happened and I was self-medicating.
Fair enough.
Were
you sober before you moved to New York?
No, I got sober like 3-4 months after moving here. It was not part of the plan.
That is not traditional. Yeah.
Nothing. I mean, I'm sure you're learning nothing about me is traditional.
It's funny to think moving to a big city like New York. I mean, I lived in LA for 2 years, and it was like the most self-destructive time period of my life. I did not get sober when I lived there. So before we get there then, restaurants and drinking, like when does that become problematic where you're like, oh, shit.
Well, you know, I always knew on some level that it was that the drinking was problematic. But it was like, it was so normal because when you work in the restaurant industry, your friends are also in the restaurant industry, fellow bartenders, fellow servers, So I drank the way my friends drank. So I didn't know that there was anything, quote, wrong with that, you know?
Yeah.
I had these moments, you know, I would have more morning afters of like blackouts and being like, oh man, that was scary. But I just wrote it off as like, that's just part of the party. Ha ha. I didn't really take it seriously until I moved to New York and I met normal drinkers. And they looked at me. Well, so like, you know, let's say I was taking writing classes and we would get beers after a writing class. Everyone was content with their one or two beers. And I'm like ordering rounds of shots and they're like, whoa, what are you doing? We're just having a beer. Yeah. And that was the first time I saw the way that I saw that I drink in a very unhealthy way.
Yeah.
And I slowed down a bit for those few months. And then I realized that alcohol's not, it's not helping me in any way.
Was shame entering into that before you realized that, like, right? Cause the way you describe that setting of like, people are going to be there like, whoa, what are you doing? I would feel like, oh fuck, what? And shame.
Yeah, it was embarrassing. You know, they weren't mean, It was, they were friendly and they were joking with me like, oh no, like I'm good. You know, I'm not taking a shot on a Tuesday at 4. So, it was enlightening,
okay,
you know, and it really made me think.
Gotcha. And what role did shame play leading up to that point? Were you having, and I ask this, most of my questions are some projection of my own shit. But just like, I relate a lot to the 3 a.m. like wake up, spend a little time in regret, maybe go through your phone, be like, what kind of fucking terrible mistakes have I made? Did that play any sort of role? Maybe not in that exact detail, but.
Yeah, I mean, it just started to add up. You know, I was, like you say, looking at your phone the next morning, I'm like looking at my bank account. I'm like, whoa, I spent $75 last night. Yeah. What did I buy? You know, like stuff like that was really telling. I don't know that it wasn't really shame. Okay. It was self-destruction. It was denial. It was hiding. But I don't know that I felt shame about it.
Where was this all taking place? Because after you get out of school and everything, are you still going back and forth between Texas and California? Did you settle in somewhere during your 20s?
No, I stayed in Texas until I moved to New York.
Okay.
At age 29.
Okay. And are you going to college or anything after high school?
Yeah, I did, but it literally took me 10 years to get through college. I graduated at 28. And I just struggled with school. Yeah. I was struggling in life, you know, I'm binge drinking on a almost nightly basis. So it's not a surprise. I struggled with going to school and doing homework. So I would take a semester here and there, and then sometimes I'd drop out but I eventually finished and I got a business degree and, and then shortly after graduating from college, that's when I got back into writing. I wanted the business degree because it was a practical choice. You know, my grandfather, who was paying for college, he was like, you're not going to study journalism. There's not enough money in that. And I was like, okay. So I picked a business degree and I'm actually grateful that I went that route because, as you know, a big part of being a creative person is juggling invoices and chasing down payments and you're managing a business.
All the boring stuff. Yeah.
I'm grateful to have that, that training as well.
Yeah.
And then writing classes, I still take writing classes all the time. You know, I'm still honing in on my craft.
That's awesome. Yeah. I didn't go to school until I was 28. So. Relatable.
Okay.
And I thankfully had that time to realize that like business degree is a universal thing, that like I'm gonna do that because also there's no major in like drinking and playing guitar for whatever reason, so I'm gonna
unfortunately at least not yet
skip out on that, I guess. And so I commend that. I think it's a great way to go, and as you mentioned, more creative people should realize like there is that side of it. Like if you actually want to do that with your life, you got to deal with the actual, you know, black and white paperwork part of it, which is annoying.
Yeah. I have a lot of, you know, in my line of work, I have many friends that are journalists, authors, writers, actors that are really skilled and talented at their craft. I have no idea how to market their work. And I'm very lucky to have that balance of both. But you have to have it. Like you could be the greatest writer in the world, but if you're not putting your work out there, no one's going to just like knock on your door and be like, "Hey, do you want a book deal?" You have to put yourself out there. And
I wish they did that.
Know how to market and self-promotion and all of that.
Guys, tis the season. The season is the reason, and the reason for the season is the season. Of course, I'm talking about Bravis Brewing, the non-alcoholic brewery and the only, you know, non-alcoholic brewery to make a barrel-aged stout. So if you like those non-alcoholic beers and you want to cut down on your alcohol or keep being a sober, awesome warrior face, that's a thing, then you need to go to bravis.com and use code FRIENDREQUEST at checkout. Save yourself 10% on your next order. They are so good. I've already ordered so many bottles of this barrel-aged stout. Why don't more NA breweries do this? Probably because Bravis does it best. Find out for yourself. Bravis.com, B-R-A-V-U-S, and use code FRIENDREQUEST at checkout to save 10%. Supporting our sponsors supports the show. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Back to the show. Yeah, that's I'm excited to get into that. As like writing's a whole thing. Oh god. Anyway, before we get there, can we shift the lens to sex, sexuality?
Yeah.
The overarching umbrella of a lot of your work. I'm curious, and I try to approach this topic or any sensitive topic with the idea that like we've created this space where we can discuss things, no judgment. And so I apologize if I ever come off as ignorant in questioning or anything, but the little I know of you, you identify queer just generally?
Yeah. I lead with bi, okay. Bisexual. Yeah. But queer is the umbrella. Yeah. And I love that you know, gave the disclaimer of like, you're just trying to learn, yeah. You know, like it's we need more conversations like that.
Yeah. I'm very proud of that, creating that space and allowing that to happen. It's been really rewarding in like other people listening to things being like, I didn't know I could like ask questions. Like, yeah, that's kind of the point.
Yeah. But, yeah. I think it's great. I'm glad that you're doing it.
Yeah. On that note, when do you start discovering like, oh, I'm bi, or I might have feelings for someone other than like men as I've been taught growing up or whatever that looks like?
I knew from like when I was as a teenager, I knew I was attracted to men and women.
Okay.
And, you know, back to shame, I'm very grateful that I did not experience any shame with that because I have two gay family members. I have a gay aunt and a gay uncle. So I had that representation. I had that visibility and I knew that like, that's just how some people are, yeah, you know? Yeah. So I never hid it. I never felt like there was anything wrong with me. And I am so grateful for that because that shame and that stigma literally kills people. Leads people to homelessness, substance abuse, getting into toxic, unhealthy relationships because they're kicked out by their family members. So I'm very grateful to have a loving, supportive mom who was very accepting of me for being me. And I had the visibility of both of her siblings being queer. I dated women, but I never fully embraced the term bisexual until my early 30s, like in early-ish sobriety. Just because I thought that, you know, there was a lot of internalized biphobia that I was dealing with and I was unpacking. I thought you had to be a certain, I don't know. I thought I wasn't bi enough, basically.
Well, that's a whole, almost like a, I'm trying to think of the same term for like, if you're feeling racist against yourself for being black, right? That's like feeling, because in the queer community, right, there's a whole stigma about bisexuals from gay people that might think like, oh, that's not a thing. You're just not saying you're gay yet. And well, that's
exactly. There's a lot of misrepresentation in media, just of marginalized communities in general. Yeah. But especially for bi people, I mean, even within the queer community, I still experience discrimination just because a lot of people just don't understand. A lot of people are just like, just pick one. And I'm like, it's like, that's just such a stupid thing to ask. You know, like that's like asking someone to only be attracted to like redheads or brunettes. Like that's just not, that's so dumb. It's just dumb. Yeah. But it comes from, like you're saying, there's these internalized societal norms.
Internalized where, like, was the word that was just not popping in my head.
Yeah. Internalized. Like, and like you're saying, a lot of people of color experience, you know, internalized racism because they grew up.
Yeah.
In a racist society, thinking there's something wrong with them for their skin color. So these are things, and this happens with men too. You know, there is this, that's what toxic masculinity is. It's, you know, there's this perception of what a man should be. And if you don't live up to that, then there's the shame again. And so I'm glad that we're in a place where we're able to talk about all of these things, and we have words for this kind of stuff, which we didn't have before.
Lots of words. I've never related to the term like straight. I think of football players that are like hyper masculine when I think of the word straight. But I've also don't think I'm bisexual. I started going through terminology, and on the joke of pick one, holy shit. The amount of, like, if you really want to put a label on yourself, boy, you have a lot of options.
Yes.
I was like, Jesus Christ. I don't even know now. And I wonder what your stance is kind of on that label. Cause there, I feel like is so much pressure to pick a label, right? Like, I need to know what you are. Like, tell me what you are, whether that be even some of the simplest pronouns, right? Like people, give me something. I need to know. I need to put you in this box when I categorize you in my head. And I wonder what your take is on all of that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm a writer. I like words. Yeah. So, you know, when I find out there's a word to describe the way that I've felt for a really long time, I think I find it relieving, honestly, to learn about, you know, definitions of like anxiety, complex trauma, bisexuality, like the word, there's the term heteroflexible that I played around with for a little bit, you know, it was like, I like that.
Yeah.
But I also know that there's some people who find labels to be restrictive, which is fine. You know, whatever works for you. I like it. Now there's the ubiquity of the word pansexual. That was not a common word when I was growing up. But like, if I was coming out today, that's probably the word I would use, is pansexual as opposed to bisexual. And I still don't really know the difference between the two. But I'm aware that, like, you know, I'm a linguistics nerd. I read a lot of linguistics books. So I'm like, I know that words change over time. So I'm also like, I identify as bisexual and sober today, you know, like other words might form that might make sense in 5 years. So who knows?
Yeah. Heteroflexible is funny. That's the word that I was like, I think I relate most to that. And I had it. It's probably still written on a little sticky note over here on my desk. I was like, I gotta write that down. It was in my diversity class. We read this like A to Z book that literally like every term to that moment that was available and the definitions. I was like, oh my God, it's very overwhelming. I digress. but shifting somewhat as far as sex goes, that can be a taboo topic to discuss in many groups. Some may argue too taboo because it's, you know, it's the reason that marriage therapists are employed. But I wonder why you seem to have a comfortability around it, if that comes from how you were raised or just something you developed over time, your openness, ability to discuss topics like that. Where does that come from?
I think that definitely comes from my mom. She's an outspoken, opinionated woman, and she didn't bite her tongue even when I wanted her to. But I think seeing how she interacts with the world inspired me to use my voice, you know, to stand up for, to stand up for injustice, to advocate for marginalized voices, to stand up for what's right, you know? I started writing when I was 14 and I was writing for my local newspaper. These framed pictures behind me, those are the newspaper clippings.
And little tawny articles from when you're a teen? I love it.
I wrote about like legalizing weed and why we need safer sex education. And
did they love that in Waco?
And I can't believe they published it. I can't believe that I had the gall to write about it. And I read these articles sometimes. And I'm like, it's pretty good. Like I would write that today, like no edits, you know? I think I tend to gravitate towards the taboo in general, just to break stigma. That's the most important thing to me, which is why I'm sober out loud and I am bi out loud and I talk about mental health. Because like I said, stigma literally kills people. People die because they don't have community or they don't have access to resources.
Yeah.
And so I advocate for a lot, but it usually is that intersection of mental health and sexuality. Because those are two big things for me, you know, I'm still learning about my sexuality every day. I'm still learning about my mental health every day. And, all of my mental health issues, like that's why I self-medicated. That's why I drank the way that I drank and used drugs, you know? So, if I can share my story through writing or speaking or whatever, that's what I want to do.
Yeah. You mentioned being published in the newspaper and stuff when you were younger. I want to get into dry humping your recently released book, but what have you done between that and the newspaper as a teen and the book? Has it been a lot of article writing? Have you had any longer stuff published between then? It sounds like writing's just always been there for you throughout everything.
Yeah. Before the book, I was and am a freelance writer. Yeah. So, you know, I would take freelance assignments, usually on the subject of mental health. Started with mental health, and then as a newly sober person, when I was like a year or two sober, I was really struggling with sober dating and sober sex. And so as a journalist, I gravitated towards I wanted to know why, you know, like I'm struggling with this thing. I can't be alone. So I started interviewing other sober people, researching the topic of sober sex and dating, the role liquid courage plays in sex and sexuality, gender identity. That all just really fascinated me. So that topic stuck and really resonated with people. So that became like, you know, I became the sober sexpert, quote unquote. And it's become my niche, which ultimately resulted in this book.
Do you feel boxed in at all by that?
Yeah, sometimes. But I'm also aware that there's a big Venn diagram in that title of sober sexpert, because, you know, you zoom out of just the words sober and sex and you break those apart. I see those as more umbrella terms of like, you know, if you talk about sobriety, you're talking about substance abuse. You're talking about addiction. You're talking about mental health. You're talking about childhood trauma. You're talking about the zeitgeist and social issues and societal norms. And then, you know, when you talk about sex and sexuality, it's gender, it's pleasure. It's again, societal norms. It's the fact that we need safe sex education. We need sex education in general. We need gender education. It's just like, you can break all of these topics down. So yeah. I was starting to feel boxed in by that. And I really had to zoom out because I don't want to only write about those things.
Yeah.
Even though they're very, very important to me, but I've also like researched that topic to death. I wrote the book.
Yeah.
So it's like, there's not a whole lot more that I can say that's new until there's more studies that come out.
Well, let's talk.
So I'm like working on the tangential topics right now.
Yeah. And let's talk about the book. Process wise, like the writer in me is curious, that moment of publication, like holding the copy and like that stuff, because that's huge, right? And finding the moment to like soak that in and have gratitude for that and not let it like keep going, because you have to keep going and promote it and do all the stuff that might not be as fun. So I'm wondering, process wise, like what was it like writing it and getting to a point where you're like, it's ready?
There's so much to say there. What was it like writing it? Is that the first part of the question?
Yeah, let's start there.
You know, like I said, I've written about the intersection of sex and sexuality for years, and I knew I wanted to write a book about it. Started writing it as a memoir. I've spent years writing it as a memoir, workshopped it for years, only to realize I do not want to write a memoir, at least about that subject.
Yeah.
So again, I zoomed out and realized I'm still obsessed with the subject, but I don't necessarily want to tell my story. So I put my journalist hat on and just really dove into the facts, the statistics, the data. I interviewed dozens of people, like dozens and dozens of people, sober curious, people who still drink, mental health professionals, doctors, biochemists, neurologists. Like I really wanted to understand, like on a chemical level, why are we as a society so obsessed with drunk sex?
You took a real scientific approach, it sounds like.
Yeah, I did. I once I took that approach, the book really started to come together, and you'll hear my story weave like woven in throughout the book. But it's not the Tawny story. It's like, it's a collection of so much research. And that was really the turn for me.
Was it easier to tell parts of your story as little pieces? Did it feel less vulnerable to sprinkle it in that way?
Very much so. You know, when you take writing classes and you're workshopping your work with other writers and you get feedback, like that's the point of these classes, is to get feedback. I didn't like it. I found myself like my classmates and the teacher, they asked great questions. They asked thought-provoking questions. And I got a little defensive. I was like, who are they to ask me such a personal question? I'm like, well, you're workshopping a memoir about sex and mental health. So, these are good questions. And that experience was helpful for me because it showed me that, yeah, like I said, I don't want to go there. Yeah. It's really difficult to write a memoir without telling other people's stories too. And I don't want to talk about my parents. I don't want to talk about other people. I want to talk about some stuff that I did and the subject of sober sex and dating. So that's where we get the book.
All right. I'm going to circle back to what you just said, but before we get there, because I wrote down something, how was the book like getting to the point where it's released? How did the publication work? Did you self-publish? Did you get like, how did that whole process work? I'm so obsessed with those processes. Like I did a whole summer series with small business owners. Like what was the step of like, oh, I'm working at this restaurant and I'm doing this to like, now I'm not working at the restaurant. I'm just doing this. And there's all these moments business-wise, right, that we just don't ever hear about. Some people have shame about it. Oh, like my spouse paid for everything while I built this up or whatever that looked like. But if you're fine answering it, I'm curious about what that piece of that looks like as well.
No, this is a great question because I think more people should talk about the process and the finances of putting a big piece of work out in the world.
Yeah.
I quit my day job in February of this year. So very Congrats. Recently, I worked a part-time retail job. I left the restaurant industry, got a job in retail that was very flexible and just a really good job, which allowed me to work 3 days a week and get health insurance and some steady income that supplemented my freelance work. Yeah. So that was great. During that, like I was writing, you for a nonfiction, you write a book proposal, which is basically a marketing plan for your book.
Yeah.
And then you submit that to literary agents. Hopefully a literary agent likes it and they sign you. And then they take your book. It's called, Being on Submission. And that is when your agent is basically shopping your book around to publishing houses. Found a great publisher, a fantastic editor who really helped shape the book. Like, right, editors deserve so much more credit and recognition, because it really is. It's a team project. It's a collaborative project.
Was that hard at all? When you mentioned the defensiveness in class for some of the memoir stuff, did you feel any of that in the beginning from the editor? Were they like, change this or anything like that?
No, because I'm used to edits. I'll take constructive feedback and edits all day long. What I didn't like about those workshops was being asked personal questions about my life.
Yeah, you should have never signed up for this podcast.
Well, and it's like, that's the only reason that they're asking those questions, because it's a memoir workshop.
Yeah.
You know, like they should ask those questions. So no, it's very different. If someone is like, you know, this paragraph doesn't make sense here, we should move it here.
Yeah.
Or this, we should cut this page. That's very different. It's structural. It's not personal.
Yeah,
some writers do struggle with that process, but I think my years as a journalist, I've worked with so many editors. Like, it's just, you can't be precious with your writing. If you're precious with your writing, then it's never going to get published.
Well, shit. So you get the publisher, the book, I mean, I'm assuming the release date, everything is happening. What is that moment for you when you have it, when you open the box and you pull out this physical copy of this thing?
Oh my God. It was amazing. It was great. Like, it was the best feeling in the world. I mean, there's these little moments along the way. It's like you sign with a literary agent and that's a huge deal. And then an editor likes your book and the publishing house buys it. That's a huge deal. and then there's all these steps along the way, yeah. You know, then there's these deadlines, and then you finally turn in the book, and then it's like, oh my God, it's done. And then you meet with the marketing and the PR team, and it's like, so there's all these steps, you know, and then you get the physical book, and then you, the book launch, and then I'm going on a book tour in a couple weeks. And, there's all these moments of, you know, now that the book is out and people are reading it and asking me questions and quoting the book back to me. And, you know, there's all these little moments that, or they're not little, they're big moments. Yeah. And, but it builds up, and it's like, it's so corny, but you really do have to enjoy the process, because God, it is fucking hard to publish a book. It is probably the hardest thing I've ever done. And I understand why people give up. I really do. It's hard.
Do you have any sort of, and I ask this assuming you do, just the little I know about you, I assume you have some sort of gratitude practice that has helped you find the appreciation that you've had for these little moments that you're able to identify?
Yeah, yoga is a really big part of my life.
Okay.
I don't make gratitude lists, but I do have these moments where I get very present, where I'm just very aware of the present moment, and I feel really grateful. Like the other night, like my husband and I are snuggling on the couch watching Great British Bake Off, and our dog is like laying across both of our laps, and I was just like, this is great. You know, like yeah. this is really great. And I feel really happy, and I'm glad that I take those moments to just pause and enjoy these things that I've worked so damn hard for. I've worked so hard to have and to maintain.
Yeah. I love it. As far as the book goes, you said you're doing a book tour. Where are you? Mm-hmm. Do you have those dates and everything all? That's like, yeah, put you on the spot. What's your calendar?
I'm traveling to two places. I'm going to LA and DC.
Okay.
And I'm doing a lot of New York events. Lots of New York stuff going on. And a couple virtual book events.
Nice.
Yeah.
When I first heard about your book, I thought, okay, I check the box of sober, but I'm married. Why is the book for me? I suppose is my question, is as stupid a question as that is. And I feel like it's something you would hear on the Today Show, but
No, I get this question a lot, and I'm glad you asked, because people think that it's just a book about dating.
Yeah.
And it's a book about relationships. So the book follows the structure of relationships. So it starts with being single, and then it transitions into dating, sober date ideas. And then the middle section is about sober sex. And then the last few chapters are about being in a committed relationship. There's a whole chapter on how to fight in a healthy way, how the importance of communication. There's a chapter about breakups and divorce. Because I felt like I couldn't write a book about relationships without acknowledging that a lot of them end.
Yeah.
And it was important to me to include that chapter about fighting, because there is this misconception that fighting is bad, and it's not. Like, you need to argue, you need to communicate. And the book is full of conversation starters and sample conversations that you can practice before you know, using them with your partner.
Awesome. Is your partner sober?
Yes.
Nice. Was that a prerequisite, you think?
No, it just is a really great.
Yeah.
Really great bonus.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that can be difficult to navigate on its own if you're a sober person and you're dating people that are not sober.
Yeah. That's another chapter of the book is how to be in a relationship with someone who drinks.
Yeah. Well, that's an amazing resource, and I hope everybody checks it out. Are you doing, and I apologize if you've already done, an Audible recording?
There's an audiobook. Yeah, I narrated it.
Yay. All right. Well, I will have that done within a week. I am currently going through so many audiobooks because I'm in grad school right now. I'll be a licensed therapist this time next year.
Yes.
But the reading load is a bit much for my taste. I'm a rare writer. I love writing, hate reading. I chuck that up to my ADHD, but I digress.
Well, audiobooks are helpful for that. Oh, and yeah. Reading, the more you read, the more, I'd say audiobooks count as reading. And the more you read, the better writer you will be.
Yes. And I'm going to, yeah, I was like, wait, did she say count audiobook? Okay. Yes. Yeah. I will agree with that. That was my own disclaimer.
Yeah. Audiobooks are reading. Of course they're reading. Like, yeah. I think anyone who thinks audiobooks are not reading, I think that's an ableist take.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you're assuming everyone can physically read.
Yeah.
You're assuming everyone has eyes, has no vision problems. Like, I just think that's to say that listening to words doesn't count as reading, I think is ableist.
Yeah. Or you're like me and you have to read things like three times before.
Or exactly. If someone's ADHD and they cannot sit still to read a physical book, like I feel very struggles strongly about this, about audiobooks.
I gotcha. The last thing I wanted to leave you with is something you said I wanted to circle back to. I wrote down a quote. You said, I don't want to tell my story. Something you realized when you were initially writing. Do you see that changing in the future? Is your story still something you want to tell, but you just want to like be comfortable putting it into an audience?
Yeah. I mean, one day I'm sure I'll write a memoir someday. I'll know when the time is right. You know, I write personal essays and I've definitely written about myself.
Yeah.
But to put it in a, there's a big difference between writing an essay and writing a book. And I didn't realize how big that difference was until I tried to write the book, a memoir. So yeah, I think one day I will.
Was it more the fear of people reading it than the fear of writing it?
No, I don't care about that. It's just more like, I think I just have more of myself that I'm learning about.
Yeah.
There's a lot of childhood stuff that I'm still processing and I want to know more about it before I write about it.
Fair enough. But yeah, I appreciate the time and I'm looking, and now that I know it's on Audible, I literally have my credit right now. I will go get that and listen to it. I'm super excited about that. I'm always excited when someone puts a book out and then I'm like, fuck, like I'm going to get it. Like I have probably three that I can see on my shelf right now that like I have the book. I don't know when I'll actually like open the book, but
dude,
there's this tweet
that I loved. It was like my book purchasing habits are very different than my book reading habits. And I was like, yeah, that's me.
Yeah. I can relate to that as well. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything I didn't cover you wanted to mention?
No, this was great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Enjoy the rest of your day.
All right, you as well.
All right, bye-bye.
You and I have lots in common. My request is sent. Would you like to be my friend? Would you like to be my friend?
All right, you just listened to my interview with Tawny Lara. I had to cut out a chunk at the end where I was just like, tell me about how you published this, because I want to publish my own stuff. But what a fascinating ride. And I tell you, I kept something in there because I thought it was important to do so. And that was where I asked her about why she started, you know, self-medicating as she described it. And she's like, that's not something I want to talk about. And then she talked a little bit more about that later on when she was in the memoir class and people were asking about her personal life. And she's like, I don't want to do that. I always think that's a funny place to come from when you want to put yourself out there in some capacity and not in others. And I guess I get that to some degree. Obviously, we all have pieces of ourselves that are just part of our private life. And especially if things involve other people, you know, I'm very adamant about that on this show. I don't want people telling other people's stories. You know, I don't talk about my relationship because that's a two-part thing. You know, I'm not going to come on here and talk shit about something that someone else is affected by, if that makes sense. I don't know. But I thought it was important to keep it in there because it's how a lot of people feel. And I think it also shows that, like, you can just say no and then we can move on, right? A lot of people struggle with saying no. And I think a lot of the fear is like, then we're going to dwell there, right? And some people are rude and they ask, like, well, why not? If you're a person that asks why not when someone says no, fuck off. What's going on there? Come on. But it was good. I liked that. And I just finished her audiobook, and I recommend you guys check it out. It's fun. It's helpful. It's truth telling. And anybody that has either questioned their drinking or just like has dated and what do you do on dates? If you have to involve a drink into your dating plans, and in your relationship in general, like, it's something worth evaluating, but it's a good book. I recommend checking it out, and you can get it pretty much anywhere you want to get a book. So Rock and Roll Dry Humping by Tawny Lara. And yeah, Thanksgiving's over. Christmas right around the corner. Hanukkah right around the corner. Lots happening. I am losing my mind. And that's just because I have a lot going on. It's the end of the semester. Got a lot of Christmas crap on my mind. And trying to sort it all out. Mentally. And on a spreadsheet. We'll see which one actually works. That's all I got, guys. I'm going to let you go. I could talk for a while. Talk for so long. I could talk about how I've had over 200 episodes, which is crazy. Or we could talk about how all of the Friend Request guests were invited to do a Friend Request guest exclusive gift exchange. We'll see how that pans out. First annual. You never know. Or we can talk about space. What's going on with space, right? Something to think about. Okay. I will talk to you guys later. All right. Bye-bye. I love you. Oh, that get weird at the end? Okay.